I should thank my parents, my mother and father, for their lifelong sacrifices and persistent efforts to provide their children with the best means of subsistence available, given the circumstances. I take my hat off to you, both of you. We've come a long way from congregating in stairwells, waiting for a bunch of dickheads to declare ceasefire. If only others should be so lucky. Not only are you survivors, but conquerors of more than one Holocaust. I also want to thank some people from the English department at the University of Sydney who have supported an unconventional and oftentimes an unruly graduate. You've heard from Margaret just how my attitude may have appeared at some point. And I used to get in trouble a lot, you know, with the Conservatives. So I'd like to thank Dr. Kate Lilly, my supervisor, Dr. Melissa Hardy, Dr. Will Christie, and Dr. Penny Van Toorn, who may or may not be here today. You have each inspired me in different ways to continue my academic work and to believe in the integrity of scholarship, and I'm grateful eternally for this. Finally, I would like to thank all the professional and amateur reviewers who have displayed so much interest in the novel, who have been very encouraging and enthusiastic about its potential, for finding its message essential in these harrowing times, particularly in this precarious political climate where the laws of the land are changing, to take us back to McCarthyism, to put a lid on free speech, laws which outlaw ideas and words, laws that can potentially turn this beautiful country into a police state. We writers are supposed to be careful now, keep our mouths shut about the coalition of the willing, build them a shrine and kiss their asses nicely before we put out the light of our intellect and pull the wool over our own eyes. The warship on page 55 of A Tree Like Rain is real. It's right here and now. It's stationed somewhere north of Christmas Island, protecting the borders from dissolution, keeping us safe from the consequences of our own actions, and also from the laws of cause and effect. And we relish in that technological and monetary supremacy and think it must be an indication of our veritable superiority above other cultures which do not share our values or our beliefs. And we continually fight against our own inevitably national diversity within this very country and speak in conflicted grammar of fragmentation and segregation, continually seeking out an enemy to help us define ourselves. Not only as the writer of this novel, but also as its reader, I struggle to understand its meaning entirely in a single moment in time, so Margaret is not alone. I don't think I can understand it like that. I don't think I can put it in a nutshell. Somebody once walked up to Derrida and said, "Can you put deconstruction in a nutshell?" That was very funny. Am I the only one who thinks that's funny? Okay. So anyway, the novel is about so many things. About sexuality and gender and society's conflict and illusions about these things, and about being so bored you become depressed. So it's about ennui, a word that has sort of fallen back from recent literature. It's about the beauty of the intellect and the sheer marvel of the universe, and about a very stupid thing that humans keep doing over and over and over again. We humans, we're supposedly a smart bunch. Our civilizations, including tribal and rural communities, are truly marvelous, marvelous creations. And like the building of the city, human communities can be quite random acts of creation over which many single individuals are not responsible and over which possibly there is not a single individual who is responsible. So I don't want to be running around pointing fingers, but we should be able to find a way for us all to coexist without bullying or intimidation of the weak or the exploitation of the uneducated classes or the sort of minimally educated classes. I think there is in the present climate, like in the last few years or so, two main ideas playing out internationally on the political arena. One comes from the League of Nations / the United Nations, and the other comes across from a more Western Hemisphere direction. And that is an illusion. And the other is potentially real or close enough to the truth. Unfortunately, there has always been two sides of the political spectrum, each worse than the other, I assure you, when they get into power. And the left and the right have always competed for political supremacy. Unfortunately, in this country, it looks like there is no left anymore. There are two rights, and one of those rights is so badly damaged by internal political quibbling that there is no opposition to a government presently in power. This is a very dangerous situation where democracy ceases to function, where democracy is a mockery rather than a demonstration of democracy. Terrible time. I couldn't help myself. I scrapped it up and still read it. Now, it is unfortunate that the Australian people must receive the most loss, must handle the most damage out of a political situation in our country, where the electorate really, really, if we look at it, has no choice. The crack in the window on page 125 is also real, and the crack is getting bigger. And if we turn our heads and don't see it for what it is, and for the threat it poses to civil liberties, to minorities, and to idealists who still think this is all within the realm of possibility, that doesn't mean that the crack will go away. I want to thank you all very much for coming. And if you haven't read the book already, I do hope that you enjoy reading it as much as I enjoyed putting in the time of writing it and polishing it. So thank you very much for your time.